And the passage for our meditation this morning is taken from Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 15. And the verses are 21 to 28. So Matthew 15, verses 21 to 28. And the caption, in my Bible at least, is "The Faith of the Canaanite Woman." The title for this service is "A Woman of Faith." Verse 21. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon, that's north of Galilee. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." "Yes, Lord," she said, "but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." Then Jesus answered, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed that very hour. Difficult passage. We'll see how we get on with it. A woman of faith. This story that we've read in Matthew's Gospel raises very challenging questions for all Christians. Questions such as how we handle prejudice, how we deal with the culture and language that people use from day to day, and how we pray. The background to the account is the accusation put forward by the Pharisees challenging Jesus' public ministry. And you see that at the beginning of the chapter, from verse 1 of chapter 15. They'd been trying to find fault with Jesus so that they might discredit him and put him to death. So they confronted him because, on this occasion, because his disciples were not following the tradition of ritual hand washing before eating. This ritual of washing has nothing to do with personal hygiene, but it is aimed at separating what is ritually unclean from what they regarded as being ritually clean. I'll give you an example. In Leviticus, the law states that a woman who is having her period is unclean until 7 days after the end of the period. The law also says that touching a dead body renders a person unclean, and cleansing is therefore required. Now, all that in my mind, quite straightforward. But the Pharisees had stretched the law so extensively that some aspects were almost unrecognizable. And in doing so, they had also created new ones, which enabled them, for example, to escape their normal obligations, as, for example, their obligation to their parents. And Jesus points that out to them in that first part of the chapter. The law regarding ritual cleansing had become a joke. I read from one Jewish site that a person with hygienically clean hands still needs a minimum of water, about a cup full, poured into the center of the palm of his hand, of each hand, and that drop of water in the palm of the hand makes that person spiritually, ceremonially, ritually clean. Of course, when the hands are dirty, they need a lot more water than that. But that's not the point. The point is, you must have ritual washing of hands with a drop of water on each hand. Then you're spiritually clean. And that segregation of clean from unclean things was also stretched the degree that made all Gentiles unclean. That includes you and me, unless you come from one of the 12 tribes of Israel. All Gentiles were unclean, except those who are circumcised and who then are obliged to obey all the 600 odd laws that they had built up. Gentiles, you see, were on par with prostitutes, tax collectors, and other sinners. Jesus, on the other hand, welcomed the company of unclean people because it was they that he came to minister to make them presentable to God his Father. I don't know how true this is, but one commentator has suggested that Jesus, in order to get away briefly from this awesome atmosphere of argument and confrontation in Galilee, undertook the long journey into Gentile territory, into Tyre and Sidon, to the vicinity of Tyre, to a place that he knew his enemies, the Pharisees, would not dare to follow him to. He was going there to have a wee rest from all the pressure on him and his disciples. Mark writes and says that he entered a house and didn't want anyone to know that he was there. He almost went into hiding. On an earlier occasion, after the murder of John the Baptist, Jesus had tried to steal away with his disciples for a period of rest and recuperation. But the plan was hijacked by the local people. Somehow, the people got to know where they were going. And before Jesus and the disciples got there, the crowd had already gathered. And what was meant to be a time of rest and recuperation, Jesus had to abandon in order to minister to the needs of the crowds around him. And that, of course, was when the feeding of the 5,000 took place. So also on this occasion, his secret hiding place appears to have very quickly become public knowledge. And the deliberate trek between 50 and 70 miles out of Galilee, out of the reach of the Pharisees, seeking rest and recuperation in Gentile territory, soon became the occasion to confront and deal with a very tricky cultural issue. As I've said, I'm not quite sure whether Jesus would go away just because of the confrontation of the Pharisees. I believe that this was one of those God-ordained and God-organized encounters that Jesus had undertaken, very much like the occasion when he went out of his way to go through Sychar in Samaria in order to have an appointment with the Samaritan woman at the well. On this occasion, this woman, having heard that Jesus was in the house in question, came to plead on behalf of her daughter. I think if the Pharisees had been present on that occasion, they would have been, I don't know how they would have taken the encounter with this woman. Jesus himself had had to give up something in order to be in that house to meet that woman. In the first place, he made himself unclean according to the definition of the Pharisees by going into the house of an unclean Gentile. He also associated with the enemy. I don't know how much of the background history do you know. You know, but when the Seleucid Empire overran Israel, the Maccabees, who were a Jewish priestly family, organized a revolt against the Seleucids, and there was quite a period of unrest between the two factions. The Seleucids tried to suppress, or they did suppress, the Jews. And unfortunately, the people of Tyre and Sidon sided with the Seleucids against the Jews. And therefore, a kind of enmity arose between the people of Tyre and Sidon and the Jews in general. William Barclay says that the distrust between the two factions was mutual, because the people of Tyre and Sidon also hated the people of the Jews because of that same historical blip. And thirdly, Jesus was tolerating the pleadings of a woman. Now again, in first century culture, women were not as highly regarded as they are in our so-called sophisticated society today. But Christ's teaching, which was later emphasized by the writings of Paul, changed all that. But you see, in the first century, before all this happened, men often thanked God because they were not born women, they were not born female. For this desperate Gentile woman, also, there were cultural barriers that she had to overcome. She appears to have some knowledge of who Jesus really was. She refers to him by his correct messianic title, Son of David, which I would interpret to mean that she knew that he was the Messiah, or the indication is that she knew. And this was at a time when people of Jesus' own country didn't recognize him as such. She was also very certain that Jesus could heal her daughter, and she was prepared to suffer any indignity to have her plea and her prayer answered, regardless of any cultural barriers. Was she aware that it wasn't politically correct for her as a Gentile, and a woman as such, to seek the audience of a Jewish male and a rabbi to boot? The details of the story are quite straightforward. She first came to Jesus crying, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering badly." And I wonder whether you remember what Jesus answered her. Nothing, to begin with. Absolutely nothing. Not a word. He appeared to disregard her completely. St. Augustine of Hippo, one of the early theologians, is quoted to have written a comment on this incident, saying this: "He who was the Word, as John's Gospel tells us, he who was the Word spoke not a word to this woman." It would appear from the narrative that when she didn't get any apparent response or acknowledgement from Jesus, she then reverted to plan B, which was to appeal to the disciples. And this she did, and maintained such a constant and persistent plea to them that they eventually went to Jesus and said, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." There doesn't seem to be much sympathy at that point. I think it's reasonable to conclude that what they were saying to the Lord at that moment really was something like this: "Lord, this woman is driving us mad. She is pleading so much that we want you to do something just to shut her up so that we can have some peace." And one theologian that I read about, a liberal theologian that I read about, has taken this view that this woman, by her persistence, forced Jesus to change his heart and attitude towards her, the woman, and by extension, she changed the mind and attitude of Jesus towards women in general. Anyone, in my opinion, who thinks like that doesn't know anything about the Lord that I worship. Because, you see, Jesus is not like the unjust judge mentioned in Luke 18, who, even though he feared not God nor man, yet succumbed to the pleas of the persistent widow just so that she could have some peace. That liberal theologian and all who think like him need to go back to the scriptures and study Christ's manifesto again. And you see part of that manifesto in Isaiah chapter 42. And there, writing about the Messiah, Isaiah writes this: "A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out." The smallest faith that a person produces is nurtured by Jesus. He doesn't destroy, he constructs. The Lord himself is the good shepherd who, if necessary, would leave 99 in sheep who are safe and well and go after the one lost sheep and go and find it and bring it back safely into the fold. In his public ministry, over and over again, he is out to seek the lost, the sick, and the socially excluded, and to restore them to himself. He never turned away anyone, whether Jew or Gentile. Often, he went out of his way to seek and to save, as in the case of another woman of ill repute, who gate crashed a private dinner party being held in his honor in the house of a Pharisee named Simon. You can see that story in Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. In the current situation, it seems to me Jesus traveled over 50 miles into Gentile territory, not only for rest, because Mark says so, but also to meet the needs of this distraught woman and her daughter. And it would be completely out of character for Jesus to reject her plea and to create a situation whereby it will be this woman who takes the initiative to correct a character defect in the Lord. I think that's blasphemy. The Lord's reply to the disciples was that he was sent to minister to the house of Israel. He didn't say that that was the only thing that was going to happen. And it seems to me that his reply, that he was sent only to the house of Israel, gave some hope to the woman, because the Lord didn't rule out any help for Gentiles like her at some time in the future, which is exactly what happened. That's why I'm here and you're sitting there, because I believe we're all Gentiles. The great quality of this woman's faith was that she accepted that the Lord had an agenda which limited his activity to the house of Israel, and that her chance would come later. What she was asking for was that what was promised, what was going to be a promise for her later, could she have it right now? Because her need is right now, not tomorrow. She showed great humility and patience. She demonstrated genuine acceptance of her helpless state. And she refused to be upset or offended when she and her kind, like you and me, were described by the Lord as little dogs. She was prepared to accept any grace that she could be favored with by this son of David, who alone held the key to her daughter's healing and welfare. Jesus didn't take time and trouble to travel all the way just to display a character flaw, a flaw in his character, that is, that of prejudice against Gentiles and against women. And all who think like that liberal theologian are wrong. The reality is that the Lord, being fully aware of the strength of this woman's faith, was willing to test her to the limit and then to hold her shining faith as an example and a challenge to her own countrymen, to his own countrymen, just as he did on another occasion when he held the faith of the Roman centurion as an example to the Jews around him at the time. As a Gentile, I'm very pleased and thankful that the grace of God and his saving grace has been extended to me also. God's promise to Abraham, you see, is that through him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And that promise is fulfilled when Jesus rejects the teaching of the Pharisees, separating clean from unclean things, and chooses to extend to the Gentiles the invitation to partake in the blessings of God. He then commissions the disciples, who by now had already experienced the abolition of the divide between Jews and Gentiles, to go to the ends of the world and make disciples in his name. And we are all beneficiaries of that grace. We're part of that number, the ones outside the sheep pen, those who need to be brought into the fold so that there can be one flock under the care of one shepherd. Difficult cultural language to cope with. But the story challenges us on many fronts. Are we faithful and persistent in prayer like this woman who didn't shut up? I confess that often I promise to pray for something or somebody, and for the first few days or weeks or months, I may do so faithfully, and then gradually I skip a night or two, then a week or two, then a month or two. I don't know whether you're different, but that's very often how I behave, and that's not very good. Are we willing to subject ourselves to whatever the Lord allocates to us, even if that includes something we might interpret as being an insult or something that is unfair? We often hear, don't you, it's unfair that the Lord should do this for me. Why didn't he answer my prayer? How do we handle what we may perceive to be offensive remarks aimed at us? This woman made her daughter's problem her own. We have brothers and sisters near and far away, some in various stages of persecution in far-off lands. We've been reminded of the couple in Thailand this morning. Are we willing to stand with them and take their sufferings as our own, like this woman did with her daughter's problems, and intercede on their behalf persistently, faithfully, for as long as it takes? That's a challenge for us. Finally, Adam Clark, the 18th century commentator, has written this about this woman's prayer. And what he quoted was this: her prayer was very short. Have mercy on me. And he says the prayer was short, humble, full of faith, fervent, modest, respectful, rational, relying only on the mercy of God, and persevering. She knew she was in need. She knew she had no right to demand help from the Lord. She knew only the Lord could meet her need. She knew that only by grace could she receive the help that she needed. And she was prepared to wait and keep praying till the Lord answered. Christ's reply to her eventually was this: woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And I think that is the challenge for us all this morning. Amen.